So, we're having fun exploring the foundations of mindfulness. At least I am. I hope you are too. There's no end to the usefulness of this teaching, not just as to help us understand what we're doing in our formal meditation practice, but also throughout life, you know, in everything. So, I mean, I always think of this practice as a 24/7 kind of thing, and, you know, one of the things I caution people about is making too much of a difference between the formal and informal practice, you know. What you do on the cushion is very important, and a training where one is devoting oneself in a very specific, deliberate way. But it's kind of like, you know, running scales so that you can get up and live life in the same way, and it really is about living life. So, you know, lest we think of the Satipatthana Sutta as just very specifically meditation training, you know, let's pan back and think of it in this much more global way. It is about learning to live life in a more full and rich way, right? So we started last week, we didn't get too far, but I wanted to say that, you know, mindfulness of the body is the biggest section, so we'll devote to the 2 weeks to that, tonight, last week and tonight. And then next week we'll do feeling, and then the last week we'll do mindfulness of mind. And in case you're wondering about the fourth foundation of mindfulness, this is something that has to do with all the insights that take place. So that is actually taking place all along the way, you know, how we begin to see how things are occurring. And one begins to understand how we get into trouble and how we get out of it, you know. And so this Sunday, when we have the one-day event, that's when I'll talk about that, because we won't really have time on this Thursday night thing to do it. So, but it's not really out of sequence, because the insights are taking place all along. And one of the things that the Satipatthana has within it that's repeated throughout the sutta is a refrain that has to do with insight into the impermanent nature of things, the arising and vanishing qualities. And so we'll bring that in then. So in case you're wondering, if you know the sutta and you wonder why I'm not addressing that, that's partly why, because we will cover it on Sunday. So, again, just as a reminder, we're looking at the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nirvana. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. And I love it. You know, that's how it starts the sutta, but it's interesting that at the end, in the conclusion, that whole thing is repeated, and in a way, the conclusion is kind of a statement of assurance on the part of the Buddha that if you practice in this way, it is efficacious. You know, he says that you know, if you do this for 7 years, you know, you'll realize the state of complete liberation, or if not, if there's a little bit of craving left, then non-returner, which is like the third stage of enlightenment, which means you don't actually get reborn in this realm, but you get to work out the last little bit in the Deva realm, living in pleasure groves for like 100,000 years. You know? So that sounds pretty attractive. But anyway, he says in 7 years, well, maybe not just seven, or six. Well, if not six and five, well, if not five and four. He goes on through this litany. And then he says, well, if someone should develop these foundations in such a way for 7 months, for 6 months, for 5 months, nay, not five, four, three, two, one. And then he goes, well, no, maybe 7 weeks, you know. If you do it for 7 weeks, it'll work, you know. And then finally he says, 7 days. 7 days. If you can practice in this way for 7 days, this can be what one realizes. So, and I love the last little bit, it says, this is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. That's how it ends. So, we looked a little bit at the mindfulness of the breathing, and trying to become aware both of this as an instruction, and in a way as kind of a description of what happens in the meditation practice. that, you know, for a while you're aware of the long breath, the short breath, and then it's almost as if as you get more and more settled, you stand back more from it, and you're able to see that from a more detached and distant perspective in a way. And then one gradually pans out in one's awareness, becomes aware of the whole body. You can actually do things by directing the attention to chill the body, you know, to tranquilize, to calm the body. And this is all part of what he's talking about in mindfulness of the breathing. But then now then he goes on to mindfulness in the four postures. And this is interesting because if you look at it, you know, what I said about just kind of constantly upping the ante. It feels like to me what the Buddha is doing is constantly upping the ante. Okay, you can be still sitting cross-legged on the cushion with your eyes closed and all kinds of distractions and stimulation cut off in a way, or maybe on retreat. But now, can you do it as you get up and walk about? Can you be aware like that? So often this is how it's taught, and here's what he says. Again, when walking, one understands I'm walking. When standing, one understands I'm standing. When sitting, one understands I'm sitting. When lying down, one understands I'm lying down. Or one understands accordingly, however his body is disposed. And this word understands is actually, it's got different translations, but it has to do with knowing. It's not just like, you know, having a cognition or knowing in an intellectual way. But I love the way Ajahn Sumedho talks about it. He says it's kind of standing under it. You know, like really being so fully in the experience that one knows what's happening from within it. So this is interesting, the mindfulness and the four postures. And I think that we sometimes the way it's taught in retreats, we actually can shortchange what's really going on here. This mindfulness of the four postures has huge potential for insight. Now, often the way it's talked about on retreat is like to be continuous. You know, so you're sitting for now, when you stand up, be aware when you're standing up, and be aware when you're walking about, and be aware when you do your walking meditation. And all that's good. That's really good, and that's right. That is a valid and useful instruction. But in a way, maybe because we learned it on retreat, I mean, I know I did this for a long time. You know, you can come away with the feeling that this is my walking meditation. This is my standing meditation. This is my sitting meditation. This is my lying down meditation. And you know, held in this conceptual way, actually miss the point that's being made here, you know, which is much more subtle than that. It's like what we want to be able to do is actually be so completely embodied. It's like you're not trying to glom on to what posture you're in, but rather just live life, be in the body, be aware as it moves about. Yeah? If you can feel that, it's a big difference. Because it's kind of like you're out of the way. Yeah, the body is living life. It's doing it automatically. We don't have to do a whole lot to it. You know what I mean? In a way, we follow the guidance or follow the sort of the cues, the things that it needs. But, you know, it really is kind of doing it on its own. So mindfulness in the four postures is very linked with the major insights of insight meditation, impermanent suffering and non-self. So, for example, if you're attuned in this way, just settled and noticing how the body, you know, keeps changing, you know, throughout the day. It's like, wow, now I'm standing, now I'm sitting, now I'm walking, now I'm lying down, now I'm standing, now I'm sitting, now I'm walking, lying down. But kind of in a way that's just out of that, outside of all of that, then it's almost like the mind over a period of time will connect the dots. It'll get it. It'll start to, just by this kind of direct observing, see very directly and explicitly and permanently. See that that's the way, that's one of the things we know about physical phenomena and mental phenomena. And we'll see dukkha, because there's an interesting quote in one of the suttas where the Buddha says, one of the chief obstacles to insight into dukkha, which is the unsatisfactory nature of things, is constantly changing postures without awareness. Isn't that true? It's like, you know, what makes us do this and this and this and this? You know, we're uncomfortable. And it's like the, you know, it's like the mind glazes over dukkha. It doesn't want to see it head on. Yeah, understandably, that's not a, you don't want to feel bad about that. Totally understandable. Who wants insight into dukkha? Isn't fun, you know? So, you know, we don't particularly want to see it head on. But this is a way to really see it head on. You know, it's a, that, it's a constant change, a constant experience of trying to find some comfort in the body by changing postures. Yeah. And it's a great inroad, mindfulness in the four postures is a great inroad to the teaching of non-self. Because, it, I mean, you cannot pay attention in this way and not see very directly that you're not doing this. You know, like the body gets up. Now, I could sit here and say, I'm going to get up. And then maybe I will get up, and so there can be a slight delusion in that, giving the sense that I'm the one that did that. But actually, the mechanism by which the body is moving about is really quite unconscious. It's happening at much more subtle levels than this, and this is to be seen by noticing the body as it goes about the day. Yeah. Yeah, I had a great insight into this one time. I get very fascinated with certain little habits and tics of my own, you know, and they just become the object of my meditation for a while till I can learn about them. And what I was noticing, this was a number of years ago, but it was this incredible propensity for, like, not going to bed when I was tired. And not getting up when I was awake, you know. There's something was getting in the way of all of that, you know. And I just became fascinated watching. Well, how are these decisions being made? I'm clearly not following the needs of the body, you know. I'm just kind of following thoughts and ideas about what the body should do or something like that. So I would watch, and in the morning especially, where maybe the alarm would go off, or if it wasn't that kind of morning, I'd just wake up. And then, you know, there would be this battle that started. Get up. No, I want to get up. Get up. No, I want to get up. Get up. No, I want to get up. You know, and torture, absolute torture to lay there while this whole battle's going on. And then over the course of watching it, like, at first I thought one of the voices was the right voice. And I just had to decide which one. And it would win, you know? and that was what was doing it. You know, that's how you got up, or not. You know? But that, you know, that didn't take much watching to see, well, that's not how it's happening. All those ideas about getting up and not getting up don't have anything to do with any of it. You know, the reason why I'm still laying there is because I'm listening to them. You know? And then, after watching this for, I mean, months, you know, I've been watching for months, and just discuss the little things, you know. Then one morning, the battle was going on, and all of a sudden I just quickly jumped out of bed, and I was standing in the kitchen making my coffee. And then I just burst out laughing. And I thought, because I had this thought, I bet those two are still in bed. Duking it out, you know. It's not how it happens. It's not how it happens. It's not in all of that. And this is to be seen. It's a direct insight into non-self. Just by watching the postures and how we move about the day. So that's a huge one. That's a huge one. I invite, encourage you to work with the mindfulness of the four postures. Then he goes on. It's like, okay, you can do that. You can pay attention while you're moving about throughout the day. Try this. Again, bhikkhu. The bhikkhu is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs, who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. This is the real statement of the 24/7 nature of practice, you know. That the effort here as meditators, as practitioners, people who want to wake up, is to keep knowing what's going on at all times, no matter what's going on. And this can feel like there's more to do. You know, I don't know about you, but I certainly felt that way in the beginning of practice. It's like, oh man, you know, I have to watch my breath, then I have to watch it in the four postures. Now I can't even pee in silence, you know. I gotta watch that too, you know. It's like, oh, this is getting crazy, you know. But it's not quite like that, is it? It's softer than that. It's just that there is a knowing in these experiences. And so just be living life and be aware as we're living it. You know, be aware of all of it. Present in it. And again, this is huge potential for insight. And I think in this one in particular, just a great ease and relaxation in life can come about through this kind of attending. You know, one of the things that I talked about with one group, it was fascinating to me, quite alarming actually, where I was talking to a group one time and I said, now let's be honest, how many of you in this room think that someday everything's going to be all right? or someday it's all going to be wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. This acting in full awareness is one of the best ways to get at that. Because that's delusion, you know. It's not, I don't think the Buddha is saying that maybe it will be all wonderful. Maybe it will be all right. That's not it. But the idea that if one holds that as an aspiration or a wish or imagining, that that's the way it's going to be, then you set up a situation where we are forever discontent with the way it is. Mm-hmm. You know? So this full awareness is an effort to cut through that kind of thinking. Ajahn Sumedho talks about this as connecting with the ordinariness of life. And that can sound morose, you know, it's a little depressing, you know. It's kind of like, I remember in my 40s, it started to come up into my mind that, you know, that is this all there is kind of thing, you know. Is this it? Is this all there is? You know, feeling really yucked out by it all, you know. God, is this somebody's idea of a joke, you know? You get born, you live years, and then you die, you know. But I think what the Buddha is getting at here is it's kind of like that famous quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. He said, anybody who thinks that doing the dishes isn't a pleasant experience isn't doing them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is a call to be in it. Be in it. Without the wish for it to be some other way. Without the wishing it wasn't the way that it is. And without ignoring it, but actually connecting. And I don't know about you, but I think in some ways this more than others has been very rich, very rewarding. The other moments maybe when you're walking about, and all of a sudden you're aware that you know you're walking about, and you're just going from the Dhamma hall to the dining hall, or getting out of your car and going into the bank or whatever, and it's all okay. Yeah? I think great. Those kinds of moments. This is an invitation for that kind of settling into the way that it is. Also, obviously, the same insights can be had through this, but I love to look at it in this other way as well. So it is definitely an effort to be purposeful and continuous and not let up, but let that be in a very gentle way. Like don't think in terms of me, I have to be aware of it, but rather I am it and there is awareness of it. You know, held that way is much more present, maybe much, much more potential for seeing it clearly. So this next one, there's a couple of, as I mentioned last week, there's a couple of sections in this sutta where the Buddha is changing the tone in a way, not just looking at mindfulness within the experience, but actually contemplating the nature of things, and in this case, the nature of the body. So there's two sections in this that have to do with that. And this one, it's called, awareness of anatomical parts, often called the super practices, the non-beautiful. We were talking about this Tuesday night because it's a big player in getting rid of attachment to things that have to do with the body, our own and other people's. So it's a section where he puts forth what's called the meditation on the 32 parts of the body. And it starts with the outer parts of the body, you know, hair of head, hair of body, skin, teeth, and nails. And then it's a litany of all the internal organs and the body fluids and the waste matter that comes in the body, you know, spittle and snot and feces and things like this. And, you know, it can be, as you might imagine, one can completely misunderstand what the Buddha's trying to get at here by contemplating these. But what he's pointing to is that there is a lot of delusion around the body, largely because we just don't see things the way that they really are, and largely out of a denial of dukkha. There is a tendency to only tune into the beautiful aspects of the body, and to, in a way, glorify and aggrandize them at the expense of seeing things as they really are. And the net effect of that is that we can develop, you know, some hefty amounts of lust and attachment around things that we find beautiful in our bodies or other people's bodies. So this is a meditation that we actually bring into our awareness. For lay people and for the young monks and nuns, they actually recommend just contemplating the first five. You know, hair of head, hair of body, skin, teeth, and nails. And that one sits in meditation, maybe taking part of your meditation, just contemplating the nature of these things. Sounds crazy, but it can really cut through the fascination. Because in a way, when I was doing this, the first time I did this, it hit me that, you know, just these first five body parts, it's kind of funny how we dress them up and, you know, look, you know, make it all kind of gorgeous and beautiful, because really, in some ways, these are parts of the body that are like already dead, you know, for waste matter, you know. It's like, you know, it's sort of like an ultimate denial of that, you know, just to always dress it up. And so he's not, I don't think he's saying don't do that, but to get it in the proper perspective. And there's this wonderful quote from one of the suttas in the Sutta Nipata that I think really sums up the intention of this part of the teaching. He says, I don't think it's the Buddha speaking, I think it's one of the monks. But he says, how else, except through lack of insight, could one exalt oneself or disparage another because of such a body? Yeah. And you, when you contemplate what it really is, how could we do this? How could we get all wrapped up in conceit and attachment and exaltation? It's like it's just, you know, hair of head, hair of body, skin, teeth, nails, organs, fluids. You know, just get it out of the head and get it into the reality. Remember, we're talking about mindfulness of the body. This is an effort to get it real. Come to the body, make it real. So let's see, I think I can get through this next section. This one's very important, one that I really would encourage you to pick up this week as a practice. This is the Buddha's meditation on the four elements. Again, part of the body, part of the experience of physicality. And he says, here, one reviews the same body, however it is placed, however disposed, as consisting of elements, thus, in this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. You have to contemplate that that is the direct experience of physicality. Now this is fascinating to consider. You know, that really, what, remember, we're talking about direct experience, direct knowledge. And what the Buddha is saying in this part of the sutta is that when it comes to physicality, the most precise and direct experience that we have of it is earth, which is solid, hard, heavy, or light, soft. Air, the movement of upward moving winds, downward moving winds. Fire, the presence of heat, the absence of heat. And water, the moisture, the absence of moisture. That, he says that actually, yeah, granted, you know things through the five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. But in terms of what is the most direct experience, he says the only one that we really know with that kind of specificity is the last one, which is the sense of touch. And that is experienced as these four elements. Yeah. So, I mean, he says, like, you know, say hearing, you could think, well, that's pretty direct. But really, if you get very precise in the experience of hearing, then what you become attuned to is the vibrations of the parts of the ear that are receiving the sound. And then once you're with it at that level, that's sensation. Mm-hmm. It's not hearing. Yeah. So he takes it to that precision, that kind of precision, that and encourages an awareness of our direct experience at this level. And it's an incredibly grounding experience. So you want to talk about how to get in your body and know the body. So this is really where, this is the ticket. This is where it happens. So like to tune in to the experience of the body as earth. And he says really all these four are there all the time in varying degrees. You know, just because it's say cold, it doesn't mean there's no fire element. It's still there, but it's just not very strong. So the earth element, what he's encouraging is a way of becoming aware of sort of the heaviness. One way you can see it is the weight of the physical body as you stand up, you know, or sit down. So what one of the monks was saying, he's noticing this changing as he gets older, you know, because it's like as he gets up, it's like, and then as he sits down, it's like, you know, it's like we have to carry this earth element around, you know, and it gets heavier and heavier through the years, harder to carry. Yeah, I thought that was pretty apt. But certainly, one way that you can notice this is in the experience of physical pain. You know, there's often if you really look into the direct experience of physical pain, it'll have this density to it, this hardness to it. I mean, it also has movement and heat and all like this, but this is one way that you experience kind of like the throbbing, you know, that's part of the air element, but also earth element, you know, that pounding sensation. This is very good to do when you're in deep retreat. It's really, you get very, very present, very grounded by being aware at this level. So the air element is the way the Buddha describes it is the upward moving gases and the downward moving gases. And these can be contemplated internally and externally. This is the same. All the elements are the same, whether you're talking about what's going on in your body or what's going on with the weather. You can contemplate that according to the elements. So just to be aware of this. You know, and I mean, this one's a fascinating one because we can get nuts about the movement of air in the body. You know, I mean, not to be indelicate, but you know, all the boats and the passing of wind and what have you. You know, there's like something wrong with it. You know, one time I taught a retreat in New England and. There was a gal there who, it was the weirdest thing, but her family, you know, taught her from a very young age that she should not obstruct the movement of the winds in her body. Yeah? So you can imagine this on the tree. And it was like a 3-day retreat, and it was great to watch it. You know, it happened to be all women, but there was like you know, the first time it happened, it was like, you know, and everybody in the room was like, you know, just trying to hold back their laughing about it all, you know, and I could watch, because I'm sitting in the front, and I can watch everybody, you know, and we'd be sitting there in the sitting, and then you hear. You know, and somebody go. But it had this great effect because over the course of the few days, we really got to. No, I was going to say desensitized, but we got sensitized to it. Mm-hmm. You know, it became normal, and it was a great gift that she gave us, really, to be able to just. Yeah, that's what happens. The upward moving gases, the downward moving gases. You know? No big deal. Let's get more real about it. You know, the same with the fire element. I mean, it's just constantly changing, constantly moving about. You know, you're hot now, cold now. You know, it's like that classic. All of these, it's kind of like the Goldilocks effect, you know, you're wanting it to be just right and not that way very often, you know. So, like with this, it's just, I know, you know, for those women in the room who've gone through the hot flashes and, you know, the change of life, it's amazing, you know. It can be a huge opportunity to have insight into this, that you're not doing that. You know, all of a sudden you feel like you're going to spontaneously combust, you know. It's like, whoa, you know. It's like this massive rush of the fire element out of nowhere, you know. I can remember for myself when I first started to experience it, you know, the thought occurred to me to go get some medicine. This is horrible. Got to stop it. And that's okay to go get the medicine, but I thought, before I do this, let me just see what I'm talking about here. So I decided for the course of a day I was going to count the hot flashes and time them. And so it was like a really good contemplation of the fire element. And by the end of the day, I had 8 hot flashes, and the longest one was 40 seconds. And it's like, what are we talking about here? 320 seconds? For this, you're going to go get a bunch of drugs? And, you know? Yeah. I can bear that. It gets hot. and then it subsides. Gets cold and then it subsides. Yeah? Mm-hmm. You still kind of tune in at this level. And then of course the water element, you know. You people in Albuquerque have a great opportunity to contemplate the water element or the absence of it. You know, very dry. Mm-hmm. The other night, Tuesday night when we had our group, remember by the end of it I was like, 2 hours of water. I need water, you know. Or just aging. I mean, you know, the water element of, so it starts to withdraw. It goes through bottles of moisturizer in a week, you know. Yeah. All that, just to notice that this is the way it is. And I can't explain it. You know, from the moment that we're born, there is the coming together of these elements. And they're moving about in various states of homeostasis from the time that we're born until the time that we die. And then they recede. That's the way it is. We can go nuts about it, you know, make jokes about it. But nice to just be in it and recognize that that's the nature of the body. Yeah? So, I mean, you know, you might ask, well, why do you want to contemplate the elements in this way? You know? And, I mean, it's a good question. You know, the objective is not to, like, be walking around going, you know, oh, look at me, I'm the four elements, you know, like you're on some kind of acid trip or something, you know. but rather to see what this kind of contemplation can lead to. You know, the experience of the body, I mean, see if this is true for you. It's largely one that is held conceptually. You know, it's the rare person that is actually embodied. Mm-hmm. That actually knows the experience of the body. And I say this is even true of people who make their living doing things with the body. I've met a lot of people who are like yoga instructors or dancers, and you'd think there would be a sensitivity to it all, but not necessarily, you know? You know, just to be in it. And we conceive it like, you know, it's old, it's young. It's fat, it's skinny, it's beautiful, it's not beautiful, these kinds of things. But really what the Buddha is getting at here is that it's none of those. It's earth, air, fire, and water. This is the direct experience of the body. This is, and that never changes. So you can imagine the potential for freedom in contemplating it in this way. If old age is something that, you know, torments one in one way or another. One can look at it just to see the sensations. The sensations of the body have never changed. It's always earth, air, fire, and water. You should feel that. It just kind of takes a lot of the pain out of it. And I think in a way prepares us much better for death as well. Yeah. You know, if we don't do this, then we get all these crazy ideas about what you have to do to make the body be a certain way. Mm-hmm. I used to watch that show, Extreme Makeover. Did you ever watch that? You know, and I couldn't help but watch it. I was so fascinated by it. It's like, and terrified. Yeah. You know, at the same time, where these men and women were going through these radical surgeries to change the body's appearance. You know, I mean, again, on one level, it's all fine. But, you know, I think what was getting me was like, oh my God, the potential for delusion and all of this is so great, you know. If I just change this, it'll be great, you know. And I kind of always wanted to see, well, what will be the follow-up on these people, you know, years down the way. But we get a lot of crazy ideas. So contemplation of the elements can really cut through this kind of stuff. And cut through a lot of whining and complaining in life. You know, I spent a lot of time in England at the monastery there, and boy, the English can really whine about the weather. They just go, I mean, and it's always gray and wet and cold, you know? It's like give it up. That's the way it is, you know? So they can whine and whine about it. But it's like we're just always looking for that Goldilocks effect. And yet, you know, if you look and see, it's not that we don't have moments when everything's all right, because we do. And they're nice, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, nothing hurts. I'm not too hot, I'm not too cold, nothing's too hard or too soft, it's not too wet, not too dry. So, oh, wow, this is nice, just right, yeah? And then there's the next moment where something goes out of whack again, you know. And so the contemplation of the elements is really very, very helpful to cut through that surreal and unreal expectation about things being just right. As long as we're doing that, then we're living in greed, hatred, and delusion. We're not in the way that things really are, you know. So this is a meditation to help us to cut through that. And as I said, I think it's hugely helpful for the non-attachment to the body and the whole being more at peace with the process of dying as well. You know, that like I said, I can't explain it, but these elements come together and they pull apart. And you know, as we age, you can actually see it happening. You know, the first two to go are the earth and the water elements. And they start to go, you know, in your 50s, you know. So the body starts to go back down to the earth, the bones get brittle, you know, the skin and all the moisture in the body starts to dry out, you know, yeah, quite naturally. And of course, right at the moment of death, the air element, you know, you completely recede. And the fire element, soon thereafter, the body goes cold. And then what you have is like it's a lump, you know. It's not a human being anymore. Very interesting. So that, and I mean, there's some good stuff in here for helping with overcoming fear of death. And this last bit, I'm glad to be able to get this in before we leave tonight. The last little bit is another part that's about the contemplation of an analysis of the body, where the Buddha talks about what are called the nine charnel ground meditations. They're meditations on death, and there he goes through the outlines the body in various stages of decay and encourages a contemplation of these. Now, at the time of the Buddha, it was common that the bodies were brought to these charnel grounds, and he encouraged the monks and nuns to actually go there and observe these stages of decay. With this in mind, where it's not like some macabre study, but it's more like this, what I am observing, is going to happen to me. You know, this is going to happen to me. And, you know, enormously powerful for overcoming the fear of death. And maybe in modern society, we don't have the opportunity to do that in the same way. But I remember some of the monks, when they go to, certainly in Thailand, they have different physicians and all have been invited them to autopsies and things like this. And one of my friends, one of the senior monks at Chithurst, went to Tibet, and he was invited to observe a sky burial. I don't know if you've ever heard of these, but in Tibet, where the ground is so hard and burial is almost impossible, they take the corpses to a high place outside the cities, and it's like the vulture's peak, you know. Mm-hmm. And usually the family leaves the corpse at some point. They don't actually go with it through this whole ceremony, but it's picked up and brought to the high peak. And there are some people, sometimes monks, sometimes not, who then are there with these huge machetes, and they chop the body up and cast it about. And then the vultures come and eat it. And he said it was amazing. You know, the vultures are very well trained. You know, not yet. they don't come in until they're told that they can come. but then they do, and that's it. That's the end of it. You know, he said it was so sobering. Mm. You know, to see that that's what becomes of the body. You know. So you know, a very good contemplation. But you know, we can come about it in other ways. Certainly, working with hospice. Some people say just go and sit in an emergency room sometime and contemplate the illness. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, things of this nature. I can remember one time when I was young. I mean, you know how some things make an impression on you. I think I was only like 10 or 11 years old. This little town that I was born in New Jersey had its 75th anniversary jubilee celebration. And we had like a week long of parties and celebration fairs and kind of very festive environment. Well, the undertaker in town was a real nut, you know. He was this Irishman, O'Dell was his name, and he just took this opportunity to go about and hand out his business cards. And he was crazy. He wore a morning suit, you know. He wore these long tails and a top hat, and his card. He liked to be called Digger. Digger O'Dell. And it just really made an impression on me because his card had, I may even still have it somewhere in my memory. It had things like, don't wait till too late. Or easy layaway plan. Or, you know, paid up to date by 88, something like that, you know. And, you know, I thought, I'll never forget it, and it occurred to me when I was thinking about these contemplations. This is kind of the Buddha's easy layaway plan. Yeah? Yeah, like, oh, that was one of them, it was pay now, go later. And this is contemplate now,
right.
Die later. Yeah? So that the moment of death is not so difficult. Yes? Oh, we got through mindfulness of the body. We have a few minutes. Let's see if anybody has any questions or comments. Maybe you have some reflections of your own on this. Is it helpful?
Are there any ideas about donating organs before you die from the Buddha or something?
No, I don't think so, because it wouldn't have been done then.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. What about in current Buddhist philosophy?
Don't know. That's a good question. I'll ask that on our own. Yeah. Yeah, he might have something to say about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've heard in the past that a nurse type should avoid the contemplation of the unbelieving of the body or the environment. Is that in line with what you mean?
I haven't heard it about the charnel ground, but that might be true. I'm not saying that's not, but I've heard it like in terms of meditating in comfortable places. Whereas, say, the greedy types, it's really good to sleep on a board and, you know, use a brick for a pillow, you know, these kinds of things. But it may well be. If you have a reference, I'd be glad to know. If you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, things, I mean, it would stand to reason, things that would arouse aversion, you don't want. Mm-hmm. Or not that useful, you know, and maybe at certain stages it would be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one more.
In these meditations, would you recommend, just like whatever's coming into your consciousness, or specifically focusing on the earth element? for a period of time.
Good point. Good point. You could do it either way. Like the way I see it is like you could do it like a juggler, you know, where you got all the balls in the air at the same time, where you're just standing back and noticing one, now the other, now the other, now the other. But the other thing, and this can be very precise, that you select one. And like the nuns would teach me this, that, you know, basically take one and like this week I'm going to really notice earth element. This week I'm really going to notice water element, that kind of thing, or a day or an hour or whatever. Whatever it takes, like you can direct the awareness. There's a sutta where the Buddha talks about directed and undirected meditation. And this applies across the board. There's ways that you can direct it, and there's ways that you just let things happen and hold it in a more open way and notice. So next week we're going to look at mindfulness of feeling, and this is very rich. It's often called the key to liberation because it's kind of the kicking off point for greed, hatred, and delusion when we don't see pleasure, pain, and neither. So we'll just use the whole evening then for next Thursday for mindfulness of feeling. Okay? Mm-hmm.